Okay, so thanks very much to Attach for inviting me, or let's say prodding me, to give this talk while I'm here today. So I just want to take a minute at the beginning to introduce the people who really did this work. So the group right now has 4 postdocs and 7 students. The people who are listed in blue are primarily associated with the stuff that I'm going to talk about today. Andrew Doherty is a postdoc in a group who mostly does theoretical work, and is kind of a unique person in that he has quite a bit of familiarity both with quantum optical theory and also control theory. So he plays a pivotal role in the things that I'll tell you about today. The experimental work is primarily done by Mike Armin and John Au, with a lot of help from John Stockton on various aspects. And I'm not sure if I'll get to it, but there's some magnetic trapping stuff that Ben Lev does, and I may be able to tell you a little bit about that. So by way of an outline, there are 2 main parts to the talk. I want to spend a substantial fraction of the time really talking about background motivation, because it's kind of, I spend a lot of time at least trying to understand how the kinds of things that we do in the lab and the kinds of things that I'm really interested in are connected to quantum information. And let's also say, I'm very interested in trying to understand what is the bigger scientific picture that quantum information ought to fit into. So I'd like to spend 10 or 15 minutes giving you my version of that. This largely has to do with topics that I think are dear to the hearts of many people in the room, namely truly trying to understand what's going on in the transition between quantum behavior and classical behavior. After that, I'll try to connect that big picture to the actual experiments that we're pursuing in the lab. And this will have to do with talking about why I think that in the context of studying quantum information, quantum measurement, quantum classical transition, one ought to really focus on really looking at experiments that perform real-time quantum measurement, and maybe why feedback is an important experimental method in terms of trying to get at some of the interesting scientific questions. And then that will lead into, in the latter half of the talk, telling you about an experiment in progress, which is kind of almost done, where we're trying to implement adaptive quantum measurements in a quantum optical system. And I should say that most of the work that I'll be talking about has been supported by the NSF and the ONR. Parts of it are also related to our MURI grant, which is administered by ARO. Okay, so needless to say, I think one of the very interesting things that we inherit from 20th century physics is this idea that when we go out there and try to understand things in nature, there really are 2 very different physical pictures that you ought to use depending on the scale of things that you're looking at. So we get used to the idea that when we're looking at truly microscopic systems, let's say in the Libni case, actually thinking about elementary particles or strings, it really is appropriate to think in terms of quantum physics. So here what you have is just an image from a bubble chamber. We have tracks of particles zinging around. And certainly when we think about collision processes and things like that, we need to use a quantum formalism in order to make correct predictions about how things work. Also, even when we think about nanoscopic systems, or let's say solid-state systems, when we talk about the behavior of individual electrons or atoms, I think by now we've gotten very used to talking in a very quantum mechanical language, even in terms of just the general behavior that things have. It's quite commonplace to talk about particles being in 2 places at once, superposition, tunneling, entanglement. These are all things that I think by now we take for granted, at least whenever we're discussing things on a microscopic scale. On the other hand, if you're interested in rather larger things like galactic dynamics or something like that, I think anybody would agree that in principle, we believe that you could describe the dynamics of a rotating galaxy or something like that using quantum mechanics. So we could write down a wave function on all the many, many degrees of freedom that you have for all those particles in a galaxy. And in principle, you could integrate the Schrodinger equation and get some sort of an accurate picture of what's going on with the motions of those stars. But of course, nobody's going to do that. I mean, even if it's computationally intractable, if nothing else. And so a thing that we'd like to rely upon is that as long as we're talking about very macroscopic objects that are highly coupled to everything else, and as long as we really only care about the dynamics of the aggregate degrees of freedom, we might as well just use a classical physics description of what's going on. So we can just use F equals ma and think about rigid body dynamics and stuff like that. Now, classical physics and quantum physics, as everyone is aware, they're quite different in sort of the basic view that they have. The way that we assign states to systems is very different in the 2 limits, and even the way that we talk about the dynamics is quite different. So I think, since the inception of quantum mechanics in the early part of the 20th century, there's always been this kind of general faith that, well, somehow quantum mechanics is the truer description of what's going on. It's valid at the microscopic scale. And somehow there's a faith that, well, as we go to larger and larger systems, which are more and more interconnected with other stuff, there is some series of very robust and sort of universal approximations one can make, such that you would arrive at classical physics as some sort of approximating model to quantum physics, as long as we're only interested in very complex systems, and as long as we're only interested in tracking the aggregate degrees of freedom. Now, I think that faith is there. I don't think we really understand very much about exactly how that works. But, you know, this to me is one of the most interesting things that we ought to study now, especially as it is that we're coming to have technology in the laboratory to really study things about the interface of exactly how this goes. And, you know, to me, if you really focus on it, what does this story say? I think most people, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, this is the kind of implicit picture that people have. Quantum mechanics is valid at the bottom. You don't need to introduce any new physics at the mesoscopic scale. And yet somehow there is this magic set of approximations that really, you know, F equals ma in all of classical physics is evidently embodied in the Schrödinger equation. And that really all you need to do is some kind of a model reduction, let's say, going from the fundamental equations of quantum mechanics so that you could pull out of them in some limit the equations of classical physics. Now, the thing to me that's most interesting about that is that if you really want to adhere to that point of view, what's the story with quantum measurement? I think quantum measurement is something that's central to everything that we talk about in quantum information theory, and really experimentally it's the heart of the program that I'm trying to build at Caltech. So I think if you really believe in this picture, right, that classical physics can be derived as some sort of a model reduction from quantum physics, and by the way, you know, the magic of all this is that somehow this limiting process in which you get classical physics out of quantum physics is incredibly robust, because it appears not to depend very much on what systems in particular you're hooking together. It appears not to depend very much on the Hamiltonians or the interconnections or the dissipative terms. But really, in some completely robust way, it appears to be the case that as soon as you put enough stuff together, you get classical dynamics. And it's not just the transition from quantum states to classical states, but it's really also the transition from quantum dynamics into classical dynamics. That appears to be completely ubiquitous. You don't have to worry about it. You just throw things together, and you very cleanly flow from quantum behavior to classical behavior. Now, you know, why is that? I think an interesting perspective to have on quantum computing is that you're really trying to break the sort of generic behavior. That if you want to build a very large-scale fault-tolerant quantum computer, you're trying to find very special and, let's say, pathological ways of interconnecting many degrees of freedom, such that even as the size scale gets bigger, you don't just flow towards classical behavior in the generic way that you're supposed to, but rather you find some way to break that generic tendency, and actually you would want to try to maintain something which is very large and yet behaves in a quantum mechanical way. What was I saying about quantum measurement? Yeah, so I think if you really believe in this picture that the classical physics is something that's derived by approximation from quantum physics, I think you will have to admit that the rules of quantum measurement cannot be axiomatic in scientific theory, in physical theory. Right? Because basically what you're doing in quantum mechanics is you're saying, well, there are a lot of degrees of freedom. I believe that they're all described quantum mechanically. But some of them, I only want to pay attention to the macroscopic details. Like the measurement apparatus, the stuff you have in the lab, you know, all of that stuff is classical. You go into the lab, you dial some knobs, and then you look at some meters. And in principle, all of that stuff is behaving quantum mechanically, but you only want to specify macroscopic aspects of its behavior. And yet you want to keep that thing coupled to a quantum system and say, how is it that the quantum state and the quantum dynamics of, let's say, a single atom or a few photons really influences the bulk behavior of this experimental apparatus in the lab? And so really what you're trying to do there is take a system that you start describing microscopically and only do this sort of averaging model reduction on part of the system. And so if that's really what quantum measurement theory is all about, then it's got to be derivable in some way, I claim. That if you really understand the details of how it is that you go robustly from quantum behavior to classical behavior at the theoretical level, that same program has got to tell you where the rules of quantum measurement theory come from. So I've become very interested in this kind of an issue of, in particular, trying to understand in this language, you know, it's a language that I'm starting to get from people in control theory and applied math, that, you know, there's a rigorous sense in which you can talk about linear model reduction, that quantum mechanics is a linear theory, and there are sort of algorithmic ways to approaching, well, let's say that you only care about some of the degrees of freedom to a certain specified accuracy. How is it that you analytically derive reduced models that can have very different dynamical behavior? And in that context, I think it's very interesting to ask whether you can recover some of the measurement, quantum measurement, some of the rules of quantum measurement theory in that sort of a derivation kind of way. But, you know, we're trying to do experiments in the group, and so what does that mean? Well, maybe what you ought to be doing is trying to take what we know about quantum measurement theory and really trying to push at the boundaries of just exactly how well we understand what the status of this theory really is in physics, how it gets used, and, you know, just the literal interpretation of it. And I think there's no better way to sort of explore quantum measurement theory than really to apply it and to really demand demand things of it in practical applications. So the interesting thing about quantum measurement theory in this kind of multi-scale picture is that, well, if you want to say that classical physics is really just, you know, you arrive at classical physics by a complex series of approximations from quantum mechanics, apparently the rules of quantum measurement theory are a thing that we have that just jump back and forth over that series of complicated approximations, and we don't have to worry about where it came from because it just works. Right? And, you know, in particular, if you just say that quantum measurement theory has certain rules and we use them and we get the correct answers, well, then in this multi-scale picture, that's a very important clue to try to unraveling what's going on. Because, you know, these tell you how to jump back and jump over that set of approximations and just do this kind of a partial model reduction. And even if we don't yet understand where they came from, we know that they work. So maybe these are something that we really ought to be studying very carefully. So to my mind, there are a couple of important key features of the measurement theory, which are things that we should push on and test. One thing that we believe is that when you are talking about measurement scenarios, there are two things that you get. One is that there's an irreducible randomness in measurement outcomes. This is a thing that we accept in the theory. And also, you know, we have these ideas of state collapse, or whatever you want to call them. So for instance, if we start out with a particle that's in a position of two different, a superposition of two different position states, x1 and x2, and then if we make a measurement in the x basis, first thing the measurement theory tells us is that, well, the outcome that actually occurs will be random between those two things. We'll either find x1 or x2, and then depending on which outcome we got, after the measurement occurs, probably we'll collapse into one of these things or the other if we're doing a so-called direct measurement. And so I think in order to really try to understand where these things come from, and even, you know, really to test the validity of these two different things, is a great way. I like to think of quantum measurement as being kind of a Rosetta Stone for unraveling all this business about the multi-scale picture of the quantum classical transition. So experimentally, we can ask the question, well, we have quantum measurement theory, we want to believe that it works, but really what is the status of this theory in terms of testing it against experimental, putting it to really a hard experimental test? One thing we know, that, you know, there's that irreducible or randomness business about, you know, the results of measurements. And what I would connect that to is that, well, one of the jobs of quantum measurement theory is to predict the statistics of measurements that we make on physical systems. And I think you can say that by now we know that that aspect of the measurement theory works really, really well. Because you can point to things like measurement of the Rydberg or measurement of g-2 of the electron, and you can find situations where there is agreement in average values of the predictions of theory and the actual experimental outcomes to 14, 15 decimal places. So in terms of predicting the statistics of measurement outcomes, quantum measurement theory as we have it, you just apply it blindly and it works really well. But I think that I would say is that when it comes to that other business about wave function collapse, you know, I think the quantum measurement theory makes very definite predictions. If you really describe in a complete way that we have some system, we couple it by some Hamiltonian to a meter, there's some interaction, we take the meter away, we do measurement on it, right? There are very definite predictions from the quantum measurement theory about how the measured system evolves conditioned upon the actual result that you get in the measurement. But I would claim that the status of things so far is that is not, that aspect of the theory is not so well tested in comparisons to experiment. And a lot of the things about, you know, we apply that kind of language these days, especially in quantum optics, we apply that kind of language very directly and very literally when we're talking about our experiments. But some aspects are a little bit funny. Like, you know, I think if you really sit down and think about it, there is no thing that we can do in the lab that really looks like a projective measurement. Right? We often take things like photon counting or something like that, and we think of them as projective measurements, but they're not really. They don't adhere to that whole business of collapsing into an eigenstate of an observable. They have the same kind of statistics, right? When you count photons, you get statistics that are proportional to projections of the electromagnetic field onto Fock states. But after the measurement is done, you have no photons left, so it's not a canonical measurement. But I think, you know, we're very loose and free in applying this kind of language whenever we talk about experiments in quantum optics, especially now these days when we have things like stochastic Schrodinger equation, and we claim that in experimental setups we have in optical and atomic physics, we think that we can look at this kind of conditional evolution. So I think it's now becoming germane to really examine how this language gets applied and try to ask just how well, you know, to what extent is all of this language just an idealization that we should never expect to really have? Or if it's not just an idealization and actually applies in a literal sense, why is that? Like, I've always been very puzzled by the fact that when we claim to do something like a projective measurement, say even in photon counting, you know, we want to say that after you make a measurement, the state of the system gets projected into a pure state. And that's actually kind of amazing when you say that actually you're taking a quantum system, coupling it to a meter, which you also want to think about quantum mechanically, and there's a huge amount of entropy in our description of the initial state of the meter. These things couple in a Hamiltonian way, and yet somehow we want to claim that after that measurement is done, none of that entropy is supposed to sneak back into uncertainty in the post-measurement state of the system. You know, somehow your intuition is, well, but somehow all that stuff doesn't matter. But then, you know, why is that? Anyway, so what I want to get at then, in terms of this adaptive quantum measurement stuff, is really testing this latter aspect of quantum measurement theory in the strictest possible way, which is to say that I would like to try to define an experimental program that really tries to test conditional evolution in quantum mechanics. Or in an optical language, you would say, we'd like to test the whole notion of quantum trajectories and stochastic Schrodinger equations. So why is it that this first point has been tested very well so far experimentally, but the second one has sort of a less secure status? I think it's just that, well, it's hard to do the canonical experiment that you would want to do to test the rules of conditional evolution. What would you want to do? You'd want to prepare some known initial quantum state. You'd want to perform some measurement on it that you can characterize exactly, right? The measurement outcome is random, so you write down the measurement result. And depending on which result occurred, you apply some operator to the system state, and you say, what is the post-measurement state of the system conditioned on that measurement outcome? And so now the canonical thing you would say as an experimentalist, okay, now we have to compare the prediction with the actual outcome. The problem, though, is that there's no way to go in there and directly verify that your theory is correct, because, you know, just in a single trial of this experiment, you can't really go back in there and just compare, okay, my theory predicted that the post-measurement state is, you know, psi prime, and actually in the experiment, I actually observed psi prime. Because there's no way to go in there in a single trial of this whole thing and directly measure the state of that single quantum system. I mean, there are plenty of techniques now that are, for whatever reason, known as quantum state tomography techniques, where if you tried to set up this experiment over and over again, you could tomographically reconstruct what the post-measurement state of this system was. But we recall, if there's anything interesting going on here, actually the outcome of the measurement is going to vary from one shot to the next. So we're going to get an ensemble of different measurement outcomes on the end. And I think if you think about it, the only thing that you really end up testing by that kind of thing is something about actually the ensemble behavior of the system under measurement. And you'd like to think about ways to get around that. And it's a little bit confusing to think how you would do that, but I think there actually is a very clear answer.
What about non-demolition measurements?
Non-demolition measurements don't measure states, right? You get a value for some, you get an eigenvalue for some particular observable. But you really want to know, I mean, the quantum measurement theory gives you an operator that applies to the pre-measurement state to derive a post-measurement state. Those operators are not projections in most cases, you know, it's just some positive operator. And I think you would really like to test if that's really literally true. Non-demolition measurements are interesting, but
I think all you're saying is that you want to look at the same state on a different basis, right? When you're saying is that you want to tomograph, right? I mean,
oh, I don't want to do tomography. I'm just saying, I mean, this is one possible approach, but I don't think it really gets to what you want. I mean, I really want to talk about a quantum trajectory where you have a single quantum system prepared in some state, you make a measurement on it, it evolves in some conditional way, and I really want to establish that, yeah, I have a new description of the post-measurement state, and that's literally valid in a single trial of this experiment in some way where the language doesn't depend at all on ensembles.
Is it conditional measurements, like total correlation measurements, give you to some extent?
It starts to get you there, yeah. But I mean, it's not the whole story. It's a step in the right direction. Yeah, photon anti-bunching is the one example of a thing I would say that starts to get at this.
But yeah. Isn't non-demolition measurement a very boring version of precisely conditional measurements?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but that's it. Yeah, so it's. I mean, I think
it's a purest one in that sense. Right?
It's a purest one, right?
Boring, you, but, you know,
right. The evolution in that case is projective.
Yeah.
But let's say that you'd actually like to.
Before you get there, because you evolve to that state. So.
No, but I mean.
Well, if you did a single pure one, yeah.
He wants to start already in a boring state, right? I mean.
Start in whatever state you want. You know, I want to think about general methodology for how do you test this in a wide variety of systems for a wide variety of measurements. Right.
It seems to me for the question of actually knowing what the post-measurement state is, this is enough. You do, let's say, a non-demolition measurement, and then you do tomography on the output. Yeah. It seems to me what you're interested in is a harder situation where you'd like to have an equally convincing story. But why, if you want to have a good story, why not pick the simplest situation?
I mean, you know, the most interesting situations of measurement are things where, you know, actually the interaction between the system and the meter are very complicated, or there's a lot of dynamics going on. Your meter may be very high dimensional. There may be a lot of entropy in your initial description of the state. Right? But if you start from the basic rules of quantum measurement, you still get some prediction about how that state is supposed to evolve in such a sort of non-ideal, messy measurement. And I think you'd actually like to know that the measurement theory still works in those rather non-ideal situations. But yeah, I mean, actually, now that you pointed out, non-demolition is a good example of that. That you make a measurement, you go to some eigenstate, and you stay there. Well, you don't always go to an eigenstate, right? Like, think about measuring momentum. You know, the thing still evolves. It's some particular observable that doesn't change after that.
Any post-measurement state does not depend only on the outcome, but depends on the entire experimental setup.
Sure, right, yeah.
And there is a formalism for that.
Yeah. There's a formalism for that.
You have to describe the entire interaction between the apparatus and the system. If we know what the interaction is, we can predict what will happen.
Sure, but I want to say, I'm asking, what's the experimental procedure to test those predictions? And I claim that it's not so easy to do in a straightforward fashion. Okay, so yeah, that's in this beginning of the part of the talk, that's the issue that I want to address. I mean, given that that formalism does exist, how do you test it?
But isn't it fair to say that what you're interested in is trying to test those things in a convincing way where you can't do tomography, that is where you...
I think tomography doesn't do it for you, right? Because then you're really looking at ensemble properties. Because in order to do the tomography, you're setting up this experiment many, many, many times. You're getting a variety of different answers.
Yeah,
you know, and then you're sort of statistically doing something with the answer.
You could do sort of something in between where you do non-demolition, you check that you ended up in the same state, and then you go and do tomography and whatever you've confirmed stays in that state, right? So then you get a picture, then you get on one hand, you know, the collapse, quote unquote, on the other hand, you look through in another basis at the same state and get an idea whether it's the same state, right? You get a confirmation it's the same state, you've prepared the ensemble in a reproducible fashion, but then you use the ensemble.
Yeah, I mean, it is an ensemble thing, and I also think that non-demolition in certain ways is the least interesting kind of measurement in that, you know, actually as Asher was starting to bring up, I think it's true that in non-demolition measurements, the post-measurement state should really only depend on the outcome, or at least in sort of discrete Hilbert space examples, it's like that. Whereas you really want to get at these examples where the post-measurement state depends both on the outcome and the pre-measurement state, so that there it's really an evolution rule that you're checking, right, which will be that'll be the more general situation.
Now, when he made these statements at the Squint meeting on Deutschland, but wasn't non-demolition measurement Carl's entire thesis? And I said, what? So like, that was
boring. I wouldn't want to read it.
Yeah, anyway, and you know, sure. In quantum non-demolition, I mean, that's certainly an interesting limit of this whole process, but I guess I want to try to sort of have more of a context for what's going on and talk about really trying to develop experimental methodology, which is really aimed at these kinds of, you know, given that you have a theoretical model for how these things proceed, how do you really verify it? And so I think that the right perspective to have is kind of an input-output perspective on what's going on. So we have whatever kind of quantum system, and the idea is that in most cases there's some ways that you can drive it, so you apply some inputs that are defined in the laboratory, and all those inputs are completely characterized in classical macroscopic terms, where we go something, we put a voltage someplace, we do something to the laser, you know, we can set the laser amplitude or phase or whatever to be whatever we want. This thing then interacts with the quantum system, this somehow constitutes a measurement. And then when the meter system comes back on the other side, we have an output which we can then make measurements on. And so this is actually, if we have a system, so what we're really trying to verify is the dynamics of how the system is evolving as we make measurements on it. Right? So just think of the quantum system as whatever kind of a black box. We can put inputs in, the outputs come out, we can turn the output into some sort of a classical signal. Right? So in the cases that I have in mind, I'm talking about a photocurrent. So what we really are trying to say is that we want to claim that we know, based on the output that we're writing down as we make these measurements, we know as a function of that, say, photocurrent, exactly how the quantum system is evolving conditionally based on those measurement results. And so I think if you ask a control theorist, well, what's the right way to verify that that model is actually correct, the most powerful way to do it in general is in closed loop. So what you do is that you take this, say, dynamical system in most cases, and you close a feedback loop around it, right? And what you do is you try to design this controller to do something interesting and useful, like, say, cool an atom to the ground state of a potential, or I'm going to be talking about a situation where we try to make a certain kind of measurement. And if you can design this controller such that really the proper functioning of this controller depends in a critical way on the conditional evolution equations being correct, and then you turn this thing on, and then you can really just, what you're really trying to say is that really what we're trying to do is control this measured signal, right? But the mapping from the control input that we have to the way that this control signal behaves in future time goes through the conditional evolution equations for this quantum system. Right? So if we have a system like that and we design a controller that will only work if we have those conditional evolution equations correct, then I would claim that if this control loop works, if the feedback control loop works, that's a somewhat indirect, but I think very compelling evidence that we actually have the conditional evolution model correct. And this is a fairly common thing to do in classical dynamical systems when you're, say, trying to fly an airplane, right? So, I mean, you never have a complete accurate microscopic model of how an airplane works, much less how the atmosphere works. And so you often are in the business of trying to write down effective models for how that airplane behaves. And the best way to really verify that your effective model is correct is to try to use it in the design of an autopilot system. And then you send the plane up there, and if it flies, then that's good evidence, or that's evidence that your model was at least good enough, if not the truth. So the idea here is to start thinking about this in the context of quantum systems. And, you know, I've tried to present this as kind of a scientific motivation for why you'd want to do this, focusing on measurement theory and all this other kind of good stuff. But I think also you can make a very strong technological argument that if you're going to try to start building quantum technologies of whatever kind, or even just nanotechnology in general, you want to understand how to do feedback control on quantum systems. So that was kind of the introductory part of the talk, introducing measurement and kind of why I think it's interesting. And so now I'm going to try to introduce you to some of the experimental program that we have going on at Caltech that tries to get at some of these things. So let me warn you, first I'm going to have two slides about an experiment that we're not doing right now, and then I'm going to move on to the thing that we're actually doing. But, you know, in this kind of controller, I feel like I often need to give a concrete example of what I mean. So, you know, there's this, I guess, pretty well-known series of experiments done in Jeff Kimball's group at Caltech. They kind of got started while I was a graduate student there and have continued on since I've moved on. But the kind of quantum system that we can talk about is, say, an individual atom. And we have these high-finesse optical cavity setups where the input really is just a probe laser that comes into the cavity. Then the light leaks through the cavity, and we can make a measurement of it in a heterodyne or homodyne setup. And the dynamical system of interest is, let's say, a single cesium atom, which comes down into the space between these two mirrors. The interaction between the light and the atom is such that when the atom is in there, as it's moving around, the motion of the atom gets imprinted on the phase of the light that gets transmitted through the cavity. And the claim is that if we make a phase measurement of this light and, you know, write it down in real time, that tells us in real time about the motion of this atom. And in fact, the quantum mechanical details of that interaction are important. So to show you some of the kind of typical data, if we would look just for this trace, for instance, so the idea is that you have light going through the cavity, you drop a single atom in, it comes in, wiggles around, and falls out the bottom. So the claim about this data, so here is the phase and the amplitude of the light transmitted through the cavity as a function of time, right? So what you're seeing here is that the amplitude and phase as a function of time are kind of unperturbed for a while, and then the atom actually comes into the top of the cavity, wiggles around a bit, and then falls out. And so this blip downwards in the amplitude of the transmitted light and this blip upwards in the phase of the transmitted light, my claim about the experiment, this is now joint work with Juni while we were both in Jeff's group, is that this reports to you in real time how that atom is moving through the cavity. So that some of these larger bumps and wiggles there are actually showing you something real about the little bumps and wiggles of the atomic trajectory as it goes through the cavity. Now, based on independent calibrations of all the sensitivities and things like that, I will claim that in this data, the noise level and the sensitivity that we have are actually quantum limited, in the sense that the necessary and unavoidable back action of any continuous position measurement on a quantum particle is present and observable in this data. That can be quantified in a way which is rather long to explain, so I won't get into it. But, I mean, the issue that I want to return to is that if I'm going into the lab and trying to make measurements and prove that they have quantum limited accuracy, right, I'm saying one atom fell through the cavity, and on this one shot that we got this particular trace of data, it happened to go through and wiggle in such and such a way. And I want to claim to you that this measurement that we made optically is accurately and faithfully reporting those bumps and wiggles to you in this particular single shot. Now the question is, well, how do I prove that that's even correct, right? What you would really like to do is say, well, this is the meter that we measured in the whole system, the whole experiment, and in something like optical quantum non-demolition, what you would do is you would go and compare that to the actual trajectory that the atom took through the cavity. But this is a case where we have no access to the actual trajectory that the atom took through the cavity, right? So how, on a single trajectory by single trajectory basis, are we ever supposed to prove that these bumps and wiggles in the signal are really faithful, and that it's not just some glitch of noise that came from someplace else? So, I mean, this gets us again back to the idea that, well, we can try to assume that that information is correct, act accordingly, and if the thing behaves as we claim it should, then I think you'd be pretty well off. So, for instance, this atom falls in there, and let's suppose that we could, rather than just letting the atom free fall through the cavity, impose some kind of an external trapping potential. And then as that atom came through and started to wiggle around, we actually applied a force feedback to this atom while it's inside the cavity to try to cool its motion down to the ground state of that potential. And I think everybody would agree that if that feedback controller works, you know, so it relies on tracking the motion and applying feedback forces correctly, if that cooling loop were actually to function correctly, that would be pretty irrefutable evidence that the measurement really tells you what it claims to be what we claim it to be telling you. And so this is starting to get at that basic idea that I think that real-time feedback is a very important tool in terms of trying to verify the accuracy of measurement models when we really want to do it one trajectory at a time. Right? Because in these sorts of scenarios where we don't have independent access to what actually happened, and I really want to convince you that in individual trajectories, the measurement is completely faithful and the conditional evolution is exactly what it said it was, it's very important to apply feedback in real time, because this actually introduces a nonlinearity into the evolution of the system. Right, because we have some measured signal that depends on the state of this quantum particle, and then we apply some feedback to make the future evolution also depend on the measured record. This introduces a nonlinearity in the state variables, and so it prevents you, it gives you a situation where now when I even look at the ensemble behavior of such a thing, right, I've sort of done something nonlinear to each individual trajectory, and then when I take a look at the average behavior of this from shot to shot to shot, I don't get something which is just, you know, the same map applied to the average of the ensembles, because I've done something nonlinear. Right? If the things that you're doing in the experiment are always linear, then anytime I look at ensemble information, it doesn't necessarily tell me about the trajectories that are inside the ensemble. But if I can apply some sort of nonlinearity to the evolution of these things, then that actually is a very powerful tool in terms of telling you that not only do you have your description of the ensemble behavior correct, but you actually know something about how the thing is evolving in each individual trajectory. So, you know, this kind of work on measuring atomic motion in cavity QED is continuing in Jeff's group. This business about trying to apply external trapping potentials, Jeff's group is doing that optically. We're starting to work on something which is magnetic. But what I want to focus on in the remainder of the talk is actually this second half of the whole experimental setup. We're really trying to get at, so what are the real experimental requirements on trying to do this kind of stuff? Right, we want to claim that we can do quantum limited measurements and really process them in the time domain, which is highly unusual in terms of things that people usually do in optics or I think in solid state. So we want to make measurements in the time domain, we want to process those in real time. You know, and in general, the signal processing that you're going to have to apply there can be quite complicated, and then we want to be able to feed these things back, again, with very high speed in order to really be able to apply feedback control in real time in every single trajectory. So actually what we've been working on is sort of, we've taken that kind of cavity and atom out of the picture, and we're focusing on an all optical setup here where we can get a lot of the same physics and address many of these new technical concerns about very clean broadband quantum limited measurement and high-speed digital signal processing and feedback. Okay, so so I'm going to make a shift in the emphasis here because I don't know. So now let me present you the following problem. Okay, so and I promise I'll loop back and connect all of the stuff up back up at the end. But so what we're really looking at is a particular kind of measurement called adaptive Homodyne measurement. So just imagine the following scenario. Let's think about optical communication. So somebody far away is trying to send me information, just as a normal communication scenario. And what they're going to do is they're going to prepare very weak pulses of light, which are just prepared in ordinary coherent states. And, you know, these things are weak. They've got 10 or 100 photons per pulse on average, something like that. The way that they're going to encode information in these pulses is we're going to agree upon the amplitude of the coherent state, and they're going to encode information in the phase. Right? So they're really trying to send us information in the phase of optical coherent states. And so the question is now, if the, you know, if these phases are completely unconstrained, you know, they vary from 0 to 2 pi, what's the best possible measurement that I can do on the receiving end to try to recover or decode that information from the coherent states? So it's quite simple to, I mean, using sort of formalism of POVMs or whatever you want to call them, you can just sit down and you can decide, well, so if you're using coherent states, the best possible thing you can do is, or you know, for any signaling states, if you want to recover optical phase, you should project the states that you get onto phase eigenstates. You know, there's quite a long history of the fact that you can't really define a phase operator, but you can certainly define phase eigenstates. And so you can define a POVM, which consists of projections of these optical states onto phase eigenstates. Now the problem is that's an incredibly exotic thing to ask to do, because we certainly don't know how to make phase eigenstates, much less take incoming states and project them onto phase eigenstates. And so it seems like, well, we kind of have to give up, you know, we can't really do the optimal thing. So what's the next best thing? You know, I think if you ask any kind of an experimental optics person, I've got a laser pulse coming in and I want to measure its phase. Well, the best way to measure phase is by doing an interference measurement, right? So in the setup here, we'll just imagine that the signal beam is coming in this way. And this beam splitter, you can kind of think of as like the output beam splitter of a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So we would have this signal branch coming around one way and a reference branch coming out the other. And the thing that you know is that, let's say that you just look at the power of the light that comes out this output port. Right? If we plot that as a function of the difference in phase between theta and phi, so the difference between the signal phase and the local oscillator phase, you'll find that when these two things add up constructively, right? So the local oscillator is assumed to be a very strong reference beam, and the signal is assumed to be some very weak flash of light. So we can just think about adding up their complex amplitudes. Local oscillator is something. And if the signal beam actually stacks up on that with zero relative phase, then the amount of power coming out this output port will be relatively high. Now, if we think about the opposite situation, when the relative phase is pi, we get a destructive interference coming out this port, and so the amount of power coming out will be lower. And if those two things happen to sit at 90 degrees, we'll be exactly in the middle. So if you have agreed previously upon what the modulus, right, of the signal amplitude is, then when you apply a local oscillator of known phase, you could just sort of like let the signal come in, do a photodetection, and just see, okay, if I got this much photocurrent out, that implies that the relative phase was this. If I got this much photocurrent out, that implies that the relative phase was this. And so you can turn this kind of an interference setup into a measurement of the relative phase between the local oscillator and the signal. So something that you note about this diagram, though, is like, okay, well, how should we set the initial phase of the local oscillator? Is any phase just as good as any other? So the thing that you find is that, well, let's say that you happen to be in the vicinity of zero relative phase. Right? This curve right here is flat, and you're sitting at a maximum. So in fact, you have very bad differential sensitivity to changes in the phase of the signal beam right there. Right? So if the signal varies a little bit in phase, you can't really see that because you're at a stationary point of this curve. Likewise, if you happen to start out at a pi relative phase, you're at a minimum. So once again, you have very poor differential sensitivity to phase. And really, the best place to sit is right here. You want to start out with a 90 degree difference between your local oscillator and the signal, because then you're on this nice linear part of the curve, and your differential sensitivity is optimum. So this is a situation which is familiar to people in optics. This is called a phase quadrature Homodyne measurement. And what it says is that, well, if you can arrange for your local oscillator to start out approximately 90 degrees relative to your signal, then you can actually make a very good measurement of the phase of the signal. And in fact, what you find is that the fundamental signal-to-noise limit due to the shot noise of the weak signal beam is just as good as the canonical phase measurement, which you would inherently derive as projections onto phase eigenstates, which is an incredibly exotic thing. So this is an interesting example of something where actually, if you have prior knowledge of the approximate phase of the signal beam, you can do a very simple Homodyne measurement whose statistics are just as good as the mathematically optimal measurement that you could ever do for the purpose at hand. Now the problem is that if you don't know what the phase is to begin with, you might make a bad choice of the initial local oscillator phase. You might be sitting over here, and in fact there you get very poor signal-to-noise in measuring the signal of the state. So we can ask the question, well, there's optical communications. What would people do in a real sort of engineering situation? Well, the thing that's typically done is to make a compromise. So what you do is that, you know, this signal is coming in as a weak pulse of light. It has some sort of temporal extent. And the idea is what you do is you take the phase of the local oscillator and you very rapidly sweep it from 0 to 2 pi over and over and over again, such that you would get many sweeps of the local oscillator phase within the pulse that you're receiving. So then what you kind of do is you get to average over the sensitivity on this curve. And so for part of the measurement, you're sitting at the bad part, but for part of the measurement, you're sitting at the good part. And this is a thing called a heterodyne measurement, and in practice, it's done simply by introducing a frequency difference between the local oscillator and the signal. So when you do this, it turns out that, well, you only get a factor of 2 in your fundamental shot noise limit to how well you can estimate the phase of the signal state. So that's not so bad. All right, so now we're getting into an alternative proposal. So actually, now if you were to sit down and ask an engineer, well, what would you do in this situation, right? You know there's an optimal phase to set your local oscillator, but you can't know it from the beginning, right? Because you haven't measured anything about the phase yet. So the optical engineer would say, well, what you really need to do is implement a phase lock loop. This is a familiar sort of concept that people have in electronics and optics. So the basic idea is that, well, so your incoming signal pulse, right? So it is that this is a pulse of light. Its quantum state is a coherent state. You've agreed beforehand on the modulus of the amplitude, but what you're trying to measure is the phase. And, you know, again, this has a mean photon number of 3 or 10 or 100 or something small like that. So one thing you can imagine doing if you have a homodyne setup like this is, well, initially you start out the local oscillator phase to be whatever. In fact, maybe initially you're sweeping it around and you do some initial phase of heterodyne measurement. Then, you get some photocurrent based on just the leading edge of the pulse, And one thing you can imagine doing is, well, based on the very leading edge of the pulse, I've just eaten up the sort of leading edge, I can make some initial guess at what the phase of the signal beam is. And based on that guess, I can try to apply a real-time feedback which swings the phase of the local oscillator so that it's at 90 degrees to that initial guess. And then as I record more and more of the photocurrent from that pulse, I can try to refine that guess and essentially lock in to 90 degrees relative to the true phase of that signal beam. So this is exactly what you would call a phase lock loop. And what's surprising about the theoretical proposal and analysis done by Howard Wiseman back in 96 was that for proper types of signal processing algorithms that go from the photocurrent to a prescription of how to adjust the local oscillator phase in real time, you get essentially down to the fundamental quantum limit in signal to noise by the time you've even got about 10 photons in the pulse. And so 10 photons, if you think about it, right, the shot noise, the square root of n shot noise is still a really significant thing. And yet by applying this kind of real-time feedback, you can take an ordinary Homodyne setup, which wouldn't intrinsically be capable of reaching the fundamental quantum noise limit for arbitrary signal phases, and just by adding a little bit of feedback, you can convert it into something that's just as good as this sort of canonical phase measurement, which is a truly exotic thing. And just to show you a little bit of the math, this is really, believe it or not, this is meant more for the experimentalists, but the idea is that in the experiment at any given time during the pulse, you have to set the local oscillator phase to be something. And the idea is that you set it to your current estimate of what the signal phase is plus pi over 2. Right, so you're always trying to achieve this phase quadrature Homodyne condition relative to your current estimate of the phase. And so the issue boils down to, given the photocurrent that you've gotten so far, what is your current estimate of the signal phase supposed to be? So Wiseman and his coworkers in some papers talk about a few different schemes, one of which is just to say that the estimate of the phase is equal to the argument of a complex number A, where A at time nu is equal to the integral from 0 to nu of the photocurrent that you've gotten so far times e to the I times whatever you set the local oscillator phase to at earlier times. So you form this integral from 0 up to the current time, you take the argument of that complex number, and that's your current estimate. And so as you get more and more photocurrent, this number evolves and sort of converges towards something, and that's how you set your local oscillator phase. He discusses a different scheme, which he calls Mark II, which is derived for whatever reasons. Well, actually, there's a clean derivation of it, where you introduce another thing called B. This is another integral, and this is simply negative integral from 0 to nu of e to the 2i phi, where phi is the local oscillator phase you've had so far. So at any given time, you form the quantity A nu nu plus B nu A nu star. Right, so this is just some function of these two things. You take the argument of that complex number, and that's the estimate that you use of the phase. An interesting thing that Wiseman shows, actually, is that these two integrals of the photocurrent are sufficient statistics for the phase of the local oscillator. So in some sense, anything that you do should be expressible as functions of those two numbers. So these two schemes are the ones that we're concentrating on for now, because it turns out that the Mark II is already pretty much as good as it gets as long as we're using coherent signal states in this experiment. But after the current generation of the experiment, what we want to do is start looking at squeeze signal states. And there what Wiseman and coworkers were able to show is that you need to use a more complicated algorithm in general, where you've got your current estimate is argument of this funny number. So there's C to the 1 minus epsilon, which is a function of time, A to the epsilon, which is a function of time, where epsilon is this crazy function of time. Nu here is the time variable. And so all this is really meant to show is that, well, if we're thinking about developing experimental infrastructure for the long term, we should really be having signal processing hardware that's capable of implementing rather bizarre transforms on the signal. So sitting down to design an experiment, first thing that we wanted to do was to take these feedback algorithms, right? What Wiseman and coworkers were able to show was that ideally, if you implement these kinds of feedback schemes, you should improve the ordinary kind of Homodyne setup to really be almost optimal in the globally quantum sense. And so what we really needed to do is investigate the effect of experimental imperfections on whether or not that story still holds true. First thing to show you is just some sort of a measure of how good are these algorithms. So what's plotted in this diagram is this scale is the magnitude of the coherent state. So if you take these numbers and square them, that gives you the average number of photons per pulse. And what's plotted on this axis is the excess variance of the various measurement schemes, right? So the intrinsic variance that a coherent state always has is defined to be zero excess variance. So if you really had a canonical phase measurement for the light, then your excess variance would always be zero. Now, the standard kind of heterodyne thing that people tend to do, where you sweep the phase of the local oscillator from 0 to 2 pi, if you plot the excess variance of that thing, then you get this green line light right here. You can drive this analytically. And so the blue dots and the orange dots are simply simulations telling what are the excess variances of Wiseman's Mark 1 and Mark 2 adaptive homodyne schemes. So what you see is that for very, very low photon number, Mark 1 and Mark 2 are both better than heterodyne, but by the time you get out to something reasonable, like say 10 photons on average is somewhere around here, right, then, well, Mark 1 is actually not very good, but Mark 2 is doing much, much better than the heterodyne. In fact, in terms of the excess variance, you've got about a factor of 10 between the heterodyne limit and the predicted performance of the Mark 2 adaptive measurement by the time you've even got 10 photons in the pulse. And the excess variance of this thing above the intrinsic shot noise limit is now gotten pretty small. In absolute numbers, it's something like 10 to the minus, it's several 10 to the minus 3. So we've sort of taken it as our goal experimentally to be able to operate in this regime of sort of 10, you know, sort of 10-ish photons per pulse in the actual experiment. So one thing that you may catch, you know, or anybody who's ever actually worked on feedback control systems, you know that there's this idea that we're getting some information in real time, we process that, and then we feed it back to try to adjust the conditions of the measurement so that they're optimal at the given time. And the thing that will always kill you is if you have loop delays. Right, so if you're acting on information which is old, that's always bad. And just generally speaking in feedback loops, the more delay that you have in going from the measurement to the feedback, the worse the performance of your setup is. So what this is just a simulation of, let's say that you're making a single measurement, how do you expect the estimators to be converging as a function of time? Right, so it is that this zero right here is when you've just started to detect the leading edge of the pulse. This time here is when you've sort of gotten half of the pulse. And this time here is when you've finished detecting the pulse. So what you can imagine is that as you're just starting to detect the pulse, the variance on your phase measurement is very bad, right? Meaning that these things are way up here. And as you detect more and more of the pulse, your estimate gets better and better and better and then converges to some value at the end. So what these different things are the green dots here are for a heterodyne measurement, how do you expect your estimator to converge? So it starts out very bad, it gets better and better and better, and eventually you come to some limit. Now, the theoretical limit that you would get for the adaptive homodyne measurements in an ideal scenario, right, so where you ignore all realistic experimental imperfections, is you start out at some value, you get better and better and better, and then you ultimately come to some limit, which is much better than the heterodyne performance. Now, what these other sets of points are looking at a realistic simulation where we put in some delay time between the measurements and the feedback. And so, these black dots up here are when the loop delay is as high as 1/50th of the overall pulse duration, right? Meaning so that you only really get 50 feedback time slices during the measurement. And so there, what you find is that the estimator variance at the end isn't even anywhere near as good as the heterodyne. But luckily, by the time you get up to about 100 feedback steps, that's these red dots, and although you don't do as well very early on, by the time you've gotten to the end of the measurement, you are cleanly doing better than the heterodyne limit, and you've gotten most of the way down to the true adaptive limit. And then if you've got 1,000, that's the sort of mauve dots, by the time you've got 1,000 feedback steps, you're doing a little bit better, but there clearly are diminishing returns to scale. So again, in technical terms, what we've been shooting for is trying to get at least 100 feedback steps per shot. So really trying to process this information with pretty complicated algorithms and do the feedback very, very quickly. This is mostly of interest to experimentalists, but I don't know, I think it's an important thing to talk about. So this kind of signal processing, while it's clearly something that is done in the wireless industry, let's say, or for people who design Ethernet switches, I think it's not something that's been very common in quantum optics or atomic physics. So what we decided to do was to learn how to use reprogrammable digital logic to do very fast transformations of data in real time with low latency. So we've been using a technology called field programmable gate arrays, and these things are great. It's really a digital circuit. It's not a microprocessor, so data doesn't loop around in general. But really, your data comes in one side of the gate array, cascades through a lot of combinatorial logic, and pops out the other side. And the time that it takes for your data to cascade through there is very, very short. And the nice thing about these things is that they're programmable. So what you can do is you can, in this is sort of a stylized pseudocode. You probably can't see it, but it kind of looks like C. It's not really C. But you can program in the behavior that you want for the input-output of this chip. And then after you've described the behavior of that chip in such a pseudocode, you can compile it. And then what the compiler will do is now, so these white dots on the grid, they represent each of the reprogrammable gates in the field programmable gate array. And what the compiler says is, what logical functions should each one of these white dots implement, and how should they be connected to one another? That's those blue lines. And once you've got such a design, you can then just download that thing very simply to real devices. So these are the ones that we were using. This is one of those field programmable gate arrays. And you can, after you've decided what that program is, you compile it on the computer, and then you just download it over a parallel cable. The process takes about a minute. So you can describe a fairly complicated input-output behavior using that stylized pseudocode, compile it, download it to the chip, and now it's really implemented, and it's extremely fast. So this may not mean much to non-experimentalists, but you know, there is an analog voltage in that comes in this side. Between an analog voltage in, it gets digitized. The digital data gets processed by the FPGA, and then some output gets converted from digital analog form and then comes out this way. And so this is a plot of, like, if we just apply a linear voltage ramp at the input, that's this blue line. This is an oscilloscope trace. This axis is the time. This axis is the voltage. Right, so we get a linear ramp in the voltage, and what we ask the FPGA to do is to convert that into a Gaussian. This is a very nonlinear transform. It's something you would never try to do with a purely analog circuit, but if we look at the output we get there, we can have a nice Gaussian coming out the back end. Right, so these are just, both of these things are connected to an oscilloscope in real time, and sort of the shift from here to there, or from there to there, that's an indication of the overall delay in the processing by this whole circuit board. And it's very small. You can see it's something like 150 nanoseconds. That's incredibly fast for something that you'd be doing this kind of a complicated transform on. I think previous ways that people have done signal processing and feedback, and at least in optics, you wouldn't be able to achieve that. So that's how we've solved that. So remember, there's this issue of loop delay, and what that was trying to show you is, well, technically, how do we try to address that problem? Because this is an imperfection that will interfere, would prevent us from trying to compare what we actually do in the lab to these interesting predictions about trying to make quantum limited measurements.
So is it the frequency of the laser sets what is a reasonable time delay for what you're doing?
Yeah, actually, I'll show that in just a second. So now the other challenge is, if we're trying to really do something about the quantum limits to the signal to noise in a measurement, we have to ensure that all of the noise that's around is actually quantum mechanical in origin. In an optical measurement, this says that we have to only have shot noise. We're not allowed to have any other kind of extrinsic technical noise in the measurement. And so, you know, a lot of people do measurements on squeezing, where you show that you can get, you know, the quantum limited measurements. But those experiments have basically all been narrow band. So they go around some carrier and they look in a narrow frequency window around the carrier. Now, what's different about what we're doing is that we're trying to really do measurement and feedback in the time domain, which necessitates really looking over very, very broad ranges of frequency. So here we're talking about, well, if you think about it, we need 100 time slices per pulse. So evidently, we need to be looking over 2 decades of frequency, right? A factor of 100 in the frequency that we're looking at. So what I'm showing you here is, like, so I decided to start out with the best laser that I knew how to buy off the shelf. It's a non-planar ring oscillator neodymium YAG laser. So it's a thing that you buy for some amount of money. And, you know, this is one of the best and quietest lasers that you could ever imagine buying. So if you just take the light that comes out of that thing and then put it on a detector, right? So if you really had a quantum limited beam and you just look at its intensity noise, you should see a white spectrum, because it should just be the Poisson shot noise. So if you look at spectral density fluctuations, it should be white. But what you actually see for even like one of the best lasers you can get is this red trace here. This is this axis is frequency. This is on a log scale spectral density of fluctuations. And that's not even close to being a white noise spectrum. It's got this huge mound of relaxation oscillations centered around 400 kilohertz. So you've got to get rid of all of that stuff in order to be saying anything about doing quantum limited measurement. And in fact, when the noise that you care about is that high, when it's several hundred kilohertz, there's no way to actively get rid of that. In fact, it's generally true that there's no kind of active servo you can build that will get the intensity noise of a laser down to the shot noise limit. So what you have to do is essentially passively filter it. So what we did was to construct a very high quality factor optical resonator. So this is just a Fabry-Pérot cavity, but it's got a very long ring down time. It's 16 microseconds. And if you can actually lock the laser to that cavity and jam the light through, what you can observe is now if we put a photodetector here on the other side of this cleaning cavity, we're able to observe this noise spectrum, which except for these two things here, which are actually just the room lights, and then some low frequency tail of noise down here, we see a very nice flat white frequency spectrum. And in fact, by looking at the dependence of the overall variance on the DC power coming out of the laser, we're able to verify that this really is shot noise limited. So all we're seeing is the Poisson fluctuations of light. And if you look at the scales, we start to be shot noise limited somewhere just under 100 kilohertz. And then it pretty much goes up from there. We're completely shot noise limited. So the low end of the frequency spectrum where we can operate is defined by this noise tail coming up. So the slowest frequency in the whole story is 100 kilohertz. Now, if we need 100 time slices per pulse, that means that we need to be doing our feedback 100 times faster than that. Namely, we need to be getting up in the range of 10 megahertz. And that's why it's so crucial to be able to have this kind of 100 nanosecond loop delay in the digital signal processing with the FPGA. One other thing that I think is interesting to show, again, it's mostly experimental though, is that we can take the entire experiment. So this is kind of a dynamical system model that we made in MATLAB that includes all of the imperfections in the measurement, in the experiment, the way that it's actually implemented, but it's trying to implement one of these adaptive phase measurements. And by using this kind of a thing, which has a nice graphical interface, we can go in and see, well, if we simulate the adaptive measurement in this kind of a realistic model, we find that its performance is not quite as good as it would be in the absolute theoretical thing. But we can try to investigate, okay, what are the limiting pieces of the hardware that are forcing our performance to be not so good? So we can sit here, we can adjust the RF delay and see if that's the most important thing, or we can turn certain things about the slew rate of our feedback up and down, and we can just see, so what are the dominant problems that are causing, that you know, would cause our experiment to perform less well than would otherwise be desired. And a very important thing that we found was that if you implement Wiseman's so-called Mark I scheme, we have a very severe problem in the limited slew rate of the modulator. So remember, we're trying to take the photocurrent, process it, and feed back to the phase of the local oscillator. But the problem is that the thing that we're using to adjust the phase doesn't respond quite fast enough. We can't make very large changes in a very short amount of time. That's called the slew rate limit. And that completely compromises actually the Mark I scheme. We found this by doing these simulations. But the other thing that we find from these simulations actually is that the Mark II scheme, for whatever reason, is very robust against this kind of stuff. And so, you know, even if the intrinsic performance of this thing had been not so good, in a realistic situation, this would tell us that this is a better scheme to try to implement. Another thing that we can get from that model is a bit of simulated data. So this is a little bit confusing, but I'm going to try to explain it to you because this tells you what our data is going to look like. Okay, so down in here in red, remember we're doing a pulsed experiment. So each one of these little plateaus in the signal, that's one pulse of the experiment. And the idea is that every time we turn on a pulse like that, the photocurrent is coming in, and in real time, we're processing it and feeding it back. And at the end of the pulse, we're supposed to arrive at an estimate of what the phase was. So the fact that the pulses are going up and down in this kind of a sine wavy kind of thing, this is showing you in the simulation what the actual photocurrent looks like coming out of the back end of the interferometer. So remember from that picture that I had with the half a sine wave, and we were talking about the heterodyne measurement, this is really a reflection of what the phase of the signal was. Right? So now this simulation is shown for a very high photon number, such that just with your eye, you can just pick off the fact that the phase is varying in some systematic manner from shot to shot. But you know, if we do the simulation and we do a simulation of the adaptive phase measurement, what you see here is sort of in each shot, the adaptive estimator turns on, rings around for a little while, and gradually locks in and homes on the true value of the phase. And what you can see from this slope here, there's a frequency halving, which is a little bit difficult to explain. But from this data, you can see that the adaptive phase estimator really tracks accurately the variations of the phase of the signal. But if you do the same kind of a simulation for a low photon number, I think you'll agree that it's no longer really possible by eye to track the variations in the phase of the signal just by looking at the photocurrent. Nevertheless, if you look at a simulation of what the adaptive phase estimator does, it's still able to lock in and sort of zoom in, and there's clearly much higher noise here, but it still is able to follow the pre-programmed variation of the phase of the signal beam in some reproducible and reliable way. And so if you just kind of keep in your mind what this data trace looks like, right? This is what the adaptive phase estimate is supposed to do when the photocurrent kind of looks like this in a low photon number regime. So the implementation of this experiment is kind of, that's pretty straightforward really. So this is that fancy YAG laser that I was talking about. Light gets cleaned up for various means. In this gray padded box is that high Q cleaning cavity. So there's all this stuff back here which is meant to force the light to go through the cavity there. It comes out the back end, and we have a Mach-Zehnder interferometer here, which is actually pretty complicated because we need to have a reference beam to tell us what the actual phase difference between the reference and the signal and the local oscillator is. There are a bunch of photodetectors here, and then remember that FPGA board is sitting over here, and we also have a computer which is used to record the data. So a status as of actually a couple of months ago is to get some preliminary data that looks like this. So once again, this big noisy thing, this is showing you the actual photocurrent which is being produced now. This is in an experiment. And this blue thing where you see the estimator starts out kind of going crazy, but then gradually locks in and homes in on a proper value of the phase. This is exactly like the little bit of simulation data up here. It's kind of like looking at a piece of the data over here. we can see now the adaptive phase estimator correctly tracking the pre-programmed variation in the phase of the signal. So these data are taken at a fairly low photon number. So this is for an average magnitude of alpha of about 50. And recall that the place that we're really trying to get down to is a magnitude of alpha in the neighborhood of 3 or 4. Really be showing some interesting things about the quantum behavior of it. Actually, these days, there were a bunch of issues with signal noise that were preventing us a couple months ago from taking data down there. But those are all now basically resolved, so I'm kind of hoping that any day now we're going to be able to show some interesting data in the photon number regime of interest and really try to show that the adaptive phase measurement scheme gets you better than the heterodyne limit and be able to make some absolute comparisons as to how well this does relative to the fundamental quantum limit. So this is kind of this will be the conclusions of the talk, although I have a couple other slides to show, which is that, okay, so what are we trying to do in the second half of the experiment, and how can I relate it to all that business that I was talking about in the first half? So in very practical terms, what we're trying to do is we're trying to implement the whole idea of adaptive homodyne measurement. We're trying to show that it can beat the sort of standard scheme, Wiseman actually calls it the standard quantum limit for phase estimation, which is the limit that you get from the heterodyne measurement. Right, so this gap between which you can really do without special pre-knowledge of the phase, that's the heterodyne limit, but the fundamental quantum limit that you would get from phase projections, that's a factor of 2 lower. So we're trying to prove that we can implement a measurement using real-time quantum measurement and feedback that gets us below the standard limit. And I think the thing that is the most important, actually, from the point of view of more general stuff and information, is that this thing shows, the success of the scheme would show a very interesting thing, which is that I think in quantum information it's very important to have a mathematical characterization of the space of possible quantum measurements. Right? We know that POVMs completely characterize the set of possible measurements, and what's interesting is that we can often optimize over this space to at least derive a mathematical representation of the best possible measurement for a given application. Now the thing is that the measurements that you derive in that fashion often seem hopelessly exotic. Like they'll seem like things like projections onto phase eigenstates, which might be optimal in principle, but we have absolutely no idea how to do them. But what this, especially the theoretical work by Wiseman shows, and what we're trying to kind of realize in the lab, is it is often possible to take a very boring and simple to do measurement like homodyne measurement and turn it into something which is arbitrarily close to the quantum optimum just by throwing a little bit of feedback. And I think that's a very surprising result. And what it points out is that although we know how to characterize or even parameterize the space of possible quantum measurements, we don't really understand its topology, in the sense that there are unlikely measurements that are really very close to each other, in the sense that you can take one and very easily patch it up to be almost as good in performance as something that looks on the surface of things very, very different. I think that's an important thing to point out. And so the last point that I want to make, and I don't know if people are interested, I can talk about it after the end, is that in this experiment, so far we're using coherent states, and that's really just to get started. But the idea is that if we're able to put squeeze states into the Mach-Zehnder interferometer rather than coherent states, then if the adaptive phase measurement performs as advertised, then in the way that I was saying at the beginning of the talk, that would already provide a direct test of the conditional evolution theory. Right, because the design of the adaptive phase measurement, the crazy scheme that I had at the bottom of the equation slide with the square roots and all that funny stuff, that the claim that that's an optimal algorithm is based on assuming that we know how to describe the conditional evolution of a squeeze state as we detect it. And so I believe that if we're able to stick squeeze states into this thing and show that the phase estimator still has the variance that it's supposed to have, that's already a somewhat indirect, but I think very compelling evidence that we really understand conditional evolution theory as it applies to quantum states of light. So I'm going to end there because I'm already over time, but thanks.